giving me a number, and it stopped flashing. So now they sound there. Excellent. Okay. Hello, Internet. Okay, wow, you guys also get, like, there are speakers in the roof. Apparently, I can't speak loud enough for you a room this size to hear me. Okay, so we're going to use the Omnom streaming. Hello, Omnom. For this, because it's got a kind of nicer audio and presentation and visuals. So we'll hopefully get, you guys can Skype in with someone in the room. So Bjorn's got his, you could Skype with him or one of the other guys who are here. Or Skype to me, seeing my machine here is working, just the connector seems to now be dead, which will be a challenge for me in the future with a broken machine. So I'm on Skype. If any of the externals want to Skype in, they can Skype into my call on my computer. So, games for health. So we've talked about serious games in general. We've talked about games for education. This is going to be talking about games for health, and starting with the kind of discussing the two papers that I got you guys to read, and then moving to looking at what we're going to be doing next week. Now, we seem to be a bit short on people. Is it ski day today? Is that why things have changed around? No, it's 2 weeks of ski day. Okay. No, that, wait. Okay, so that should. Right. So, games for health. So, I consider sort of a games for health to be quite an old idea, right? Because the idea of doing sports way back, sort of in ancient periods, was to remain physically fit, right? So the first Olympics, the ancient Olympics, were the idea that if you have a bunch of your soldiers sort of sitting around doing nothing, they get fat and lazy. So you have to make them do something, right? And so they actually instituted the sports and games, the ancient Olympics, for training skill, but also remaining physically fit to keep healthy. And you still see people talk about sports as a way of remaining physically healthy, right? So parents want their kids to play football, so they run around and are more physically active, right? So they see it as a health benefit. The modern Olympics is actually a serious game for social change. If you look at the vision statement for the Olympics, it's all about being an Olympian rather than physical health, right? So they are a social organization rather than a health organization. Whereas you'll still see a lot of footballers will promote football and promote it as being healthy, even though they get quite a few injuries. So there's a bit of a balance there. My stepbrother was a cycle courier in London, and they did an analysis on cycling in London, and it's still just beneficial. So the cycling is good for you, but the number of people who get injured and die on bikes in London means that the health benefits of cycling instead of taking a car are nearly outweighed by the risk of dying. So yeah, sometimes health benefits, you've got to look at the actual overall effect. Okay, so if we look at health, we can kind of generally break it down into three main areas, though these are all overlapping. And it's more to kind of look at the different types of things that we mean when we mean games for health. We can talk about physical health, right? So the rehabilitation games, the physical games talk about kind of physical health. And usually when people talk about games and health, they're usually meaning games stop you being physically active because you're playing computer games, and therefore they're bad for your health. Right? And that argument is about physical health. There's also social health and mental health. So mental health is different to physical health, but connected, right? And you can turn both mental as in cognitive and psychological. So you could talk about kind of actual, like Alzheimer's being cognitive impairment, right? So there's something cognitively wrong with you, which is different to things like depression or anxiety, which may be more psychological. Now, this is quite a grey area in health, because there are changes in brain anatomy and in brain chemistry that can result in depression and anxiety and what we consider mental disorders caused by physical problems, right? So there does seem to be interaction. And also you can have psychological events that change the physiology of your brain, which though then became a cognitive thing. So it's a kind of blurry line. And social health. And now social health is an interesting one, because it's only really, well, a somewhat modern idea that you that to treat social health as being independent of cognitive and mental and physical health, right? So you say physically health, mental healthy. If you've got those two, you're healthy, right? But there are an area of what's your social health, which is like how you interact with other people, how you fulfill your social needs. Are you having healthy relationships, right? And so this one often is where parents will also go into the, you're playing games too much, you're not talking to your friends, you're not going out and seeing people, you're becoming isolated, those sort of things, which might not create mental or physical health problems yet, but is still health-related problem, right? It's not a healthy lifestyle. So you'll see games and you'll see people talking about these kinds of health. We can also look at what you're trying to do by having a health intervention. Right? So if you're talking about games of health, we're talking either prevention or treatment generally. Right? So prevention is you're trying to stop something from occurring. Right? And treatment is where you already have the thing and you're going to change it. So for prevention, you have primary, secondary, tertiary prevention, and you have treatment of chronic and acute events. So primary prevention are things like immunization and eating healthily, right? So these are just preventing against a kind of the we've got no indication that you have anything wrong with you. You're not necessarily at a higher risk group. We're just going to do primary prevention activities to try and stop something bad happening in the future, right? So eating healthily, we try and stop obesity, and we think obesity is linked with a whole bunch of other things that then cause health problems, right? So eating healthily to stop diabetes is about eating healthily to stop weight gain, and weight gain to prevent pressure on the insulin system being protected to stop diabetes occurring. So it's kind of quite a long way from stopping diabetes. You've got quite a chain. So secondary level prevention is where you start screening people, right? And you're saying, okay, we're gonna prevent this by trying to find people who have a tendency for this, and so that's a kind of, we're preventing it by trying to find indicators of it early. And there's actually an interesting discussion on low-dose aspirin. So low-dose aspirin was suggested for people who were at risk of heart attacks, right? So if you've got a high blood pressure, you take low-dose aspirin. The medical community seem to be a bit 50-50 on this now. Some are saying, yes, you can still do that. And others are saying, well, no, we don't think it's a good idea to take a medicine because there are side effects. And tertiary, so is where you know that there can be a problem, so you change the environment. So you modify your workplace, right? So you've got an injury already, and you're trying to stop it happening a second time, right? So you already know that this has happened. So like if you're having alcohol abuse problems, you create support groups saying, you know, you've already done this thing, we've cured of you, but we know that you're at really high risk of this happening again, right? So we try and change your environment, change things to prevent it happening again, having known that you've already likely to have happened. And of course, treatment, you've got chronic issues, so often things like back pain go under chronic, so you might not have acute back pain, it might just be there every day. So ongoing, requiring long-term management, so often we talk about, weight, for example, is usually considered a chronic challenge, right, because people are obese for long periods. It's not like I suddenly gained weight and then I can acutely treat that and suddenly lose it again, right? Whereas acute stuff is the stuff happening right now, right? So if you break an arm, that's an acute issue. But if you have a flattened foot. If you if you have lowered arches and it shifts your knee position, and every time you walk, you're damaging your knee, that's an acute thing that you need a plan to fix. Yeah? So health, we kind of break them down into their various objectives and types. Now, this was the Games for Health taxonomy set up by Ben Sawyer, and I wrote about it in a paper and added some of those other areas, talking about types of health treatment and categories. Runa and I have a discussion around this because there is a distinction between a taxonomy and a market segmentation. So a taxonomy should be a description where you break things into categories, and the things in those categories are somehow coherent and work together and share features, and there are distinctions to other things in the taxonomy, right? So when you think of species, one of the distinctions is species can't interbreed. That's what defines them as separate species. So there is something that definitely clearly says, oh, you are in this category and not this category. Whereas everything within the species group can breed together. And then you look at DNA to say, well, how is this species similar to this species? And they share a common ancestor, for example, right? So a very, very clear hierarchy, very clear taxonomy. For games, this becomes a bit more complex because it's not necessarily clear that a particular game fits in just one of these areas. Right? These are certainly the market segmentation of, we're talking about personal games, are you talking about games of professional practice, are you research or public health, and are you doing preventative or therapeutic, so treatment? Are you assessing people, which is kind of a screening activity? Are you doing education and training? Are you collecting data, or are you using it as part of producing health activities, right? So biotech marketing and design is in the professional practice and production, right? So the games are considered part of your professional practice. Because often things that are preventative also to some extent become educational. So it's not a clear distinction sometimes, because what you're trying to do is you're trying to educate people about that thing. So yeah, there are lots of overlaps. It's not clear distinctions. And do you benefit from making these clear distinctions and saying, well, all the things in this category share similarities, right? And they're more similar within the group than they are between groups. And I'm not sure this is the best way of doing it. Certainly game genres is not an example of a nice, clear taxonomy, because first-person shooters as a genre versus horror games. But what if you've got a first-person horror game? It makes no sense to try and separate them as distinct genres. Or rather, in a taxonomy that says these are more different than they are similar. So the reason why we create taxonomies is to try and make things easier to talk about and to understand how they interact. So making it easier to talk about what kind of game you're working on and potentially share features. So the issue there is for the stream. Runa is saying that one of the challenges is that a taxonomy isn't right or wrong necessarily. It's utility. Can you use it for something relevant? Does it fulfill a need that you have? Right? If you need to design a game, does your taxonomy help you find features that will engage your players? Right? If you're trying to do a market segmentation to work out how you who you try and sell the game to, then your taxonomy needs to be useful in working out who the clients of the game is. Right? So you're using it for different purposes. So how would you go? So who is your target, perhaps, right? If you're trying to sell, who's the target? Yeah, so who they target, what they target, what mechanisms they use, their visual appearance, price, what, like, it depends on what your objective is as to which of these is a way of breaking down and separating out gaps. So within the health market, you'll see games for health, they try and break down to say what kind of game they are, and then they just kind of have to provide all of this additional information so that people can try and work out what kind of game it is. Right? So I don't know if those genres make much sense, but it's useful to be able to kind of break it into areas and just not to try and keep the whole field in your head at the same time. So if we have a look at the two papers, and I can actually go over to the Prezi, because I have a whole bunch of examples of games in each of these categories. And seeing we're on the stream, I might as well jump over to it. And I can go... So I thought I'd show the quick breakdown. If I can log in. Aha, I can. And print. And grab that and move it over to here. Aha. So, so this is educational news, so we're okay. Okay. Gotta make it in focus. Right. So I had a look at these areas and looked at the preventive therapeutic assessment, and then looked at different areas. So within personal health, I broke it down to physical, mental, social. Not that many in the social health, so you don't need to look at it. So there isn't many to talk about. But here, think of this as things like the Wii Fit. There was a game, the Spanish Maid, Dance Don't Fall. All of these kind of games on recorders, right? So physical, quantified self, gamifying physical activities. So that was my sleep score for the Basis Peak, which has now been retracted because it overheated. But it gives you a sleep score, right? So it scores your sleep as a number, right? And you're supposed to say, no, that was a good sleep, so I got 97% as my score. We had a meeting with them. I had a Skype meeting with Basis, and they said, yeah, no, that number is mostly made up. What they do is they compare to your previous night's sleep, and if you got longer sleep, they give you a high number, and if you got less sleep, they give you a low number. So 97% is completely made up. It's just kind of a picking a number somewhere between 0 and 100 and giving you that based on some very shady stats, right? So they know it's a fake score, but the intent was to encourage people to sleep more because they feel that most people weren't sleeping enough. And so you just kind of encourage them by giving them a number, even if it's fake, at least it makes them sleep better or longer, right? So, yeah. That's not what we say 97%. We think that there is some sort of 100% quantity that you're being measured out of, surely, and that 97 would be close to perfect, and it's, yeah, not at all. X Gaming, so up in Trondheim, they have a big project on X Gaming. X Gaming, certainly for the elderly, is a big deal. They're trying to keep them physically active in retirement homes. And so physical X Gaming is a big deal. Educational games, so... there was a British game on sexual health because they found it was very hard to get to teenagers and get the messages about STDs. So they made a game about STDs, and you go around and you start fighting. You're fighting STDs and you're shooting them, and you know you're like got genitals all over the place, and it's crude, but the market they're targeting is teenage boys, and so you know. So there's also an autism simulator games and a variety of other sort of games around education and giving people information about things. Games for mental health. So we've done some, and Costas was working on that. The Lumosity, there's been some interesting legal cases in the last year around Lumosity, right? Lumosity had been buying up all of the other cognitive gaming companies, right? So there were quite a few game companies who were making games for mental health and for cognitive health. And Lumosity was going around buying them and trying to be the only company in this space, right? So they made the games. And they made a bunch of claims about the benefits of using their software, and the FDA in America went, we're not sure you can make those claims. And the science suggests they can't. So they got sued, and so there's currently a debate around the actual benefit of mental training games, particularly seeing that people like playing Lumosity or playing normal video games tended to get the same benefits, right? So there didn't seem to be actually anything special about their games over just doing something with your brain, right? They couldn't make the claims they were making. One of the old ones of these, Brain Age game, yeah. Again, very popular in Japan. Lots of people saying, hey, it's helped me come clearer and helped my brain think and all those sort of things. Transfer of improvement between the game and into the rest of your activities seems to be the challenge, right? So it transfers to some people and not for others. Pain distraction is a big one. So the Lumosity games appear in here also as pain distraction, because anything that gives you your cognitive focus. So in cognition, we talk about cognitive load, right? So how, like, your brain only has so much resource, right? Both blood flow as well as kind of activity. And if you load up your brain doing doing something like playing a video game where you're 100% focused on that, the neurons responsible for responding to pain tend to lose some of the resources because you've loaded all those resources up into the visual or cognitive areas of playing the game. So you just don't experience as much pain. Okay? My mother-in-law uses this when she had a liver operation. She had a third of her liver removed, which is relatively painful to regrow liver. And so she sat and played match three games, and they distracted her from the pain. Okay? So a very effective pain relief. And to some extent, because you focus very strongly on the games, even things like VR are being used as good ways of using distraction. Skills and training. There are starting to be in VR now as well on games used for training surgeons to do things and training health professionals. There was a large hospital simulator when they were rebuilding a hospital. They wanted to train people how to use the new hospital before it was built, so that when they moved the nurses from the old hospital into the new building, they wouldn't have that downtime of people not knowing where everything was, right? Because that creates risk when you're time-sensitive response to medical crisis. You don't want to go, now where is that cabinet again? looking for the medicines and stuff, right? You want to know where everything is. So you simulate the environment, train them in the environment, so that when they go in there, they know it immediately. And also there are games where we try and do science. So iWire, if you guys haven't tried it before, you could go and play iWire, where you help them map the neurons of a rat retina. Right, so it's a game for working out the neuronal structure of a retina. And you can also look at management games. So there's the hand-washing game, and there's patient management games, and VR sim games, and we were doing a look at how you do medical recommendation games. So I was playing with that a bit. Didn't get that one finished, but it's sort of in partial build. So that was those structures. Now I'll just, so I thought I'd go and give you examples of each of those games. Now if I have this correct, I should be able to. Take that away. And where did my presentation go? Nope, that's we had two papers targeting parents for childhood weight management, development of a theory-driven user-centered healthy eating app and monitoring, right? So this is a group who said, right, okay, there are lots of games for health and games for healthy eating out there, but they're not based on theory. They're based on just people going, oh, well, you know, if we make people eat better, they'll be healthy, right? And what's better? We don't really know what's better. We don't know how to change people. We'll just make a game. It'll be great. Another one, Time to Eat, which is an interesting one from a kind of how like another way of trying to make a game and trying to make kids engage and looking at some of the challenges of medical people getting involved in game development, right? So they're similar papers but with different approach and different writing styles. You probably noticed that, right? So the first paper here is very much a researchy kind of analysis paper, right? So if you're writing a master's thesis, we want it to look more like this one, right? This is kind of more theory-driven, good structure, academic writing. The Time to Eat one, still in an IEEE pervasive computing, much more casual, kind of, oh, yeah, we did this, it was great, it was okay, and, you know, so much less formal in its writing. Right? So part of the reason to give you these two was to show you the difference between those two styles of writing and encourage you to write more like the first one for your thesis. Right? For popular presentation of your ideas, you might need to write more like the second one, but then you've got a different target market. Instead of talking to researchers, you are talking to the general public, which is why I see maybe they're a different audience. Right? So which did you find more useful of those two papers? The second one was easier to read. That's definitely true. It also useful to make it the second one. I don't know if you looked at them first and then decided to read the second one first, but if you read the first one and you go, oh, God, I'm going to read another one of these, and look at it and go, oh, okay, this is much shorter and much... it's saving the lighter work for the second bit. Okay, so if we look at the parent app, so for you guys presenting papers, you will need to give us a summary of the paper, and then we'll discuss the questions. So one thing to talk about is what's the objective of the intervention? What's the objective of this paper? Right, so some papers are research papers. This is describing the way they designed an app. Right, so what's the objective of this paper? So the change parent behavior towards childhood obesity. Right, so this paper, they said one of the big challenges is that you need to engage parents. It's the environment in which unhealthy eating occurs that's the most important, not just targeting the kid. You've got to target their environment they're in. So it looks at the theories of behavioral change. So it says, okay, let's go back to theory. How do we change behavior? What's our model for behavioral change? And what's our model for behaviors? And then they don't really care about the game itself, right? It kind of seems an afterthought. Right, yeah, it was a normal health app, and they added game stuff just because it's, like, gamification's a buzzword, and we know we have to be buzzword compliant. We said we'd make a game, so we'll make a game. So this, for me, this feels like people who are health professionals writing about how you change people's behaviors, and then saying, oh, yeah, and to do this, we'll use a game. And they not care, like, whether the game's good or not. Right? In fact, this is, for me, one of the big challenges of traditional medical analysis of game interventions in health is that when you look at health, they'll talk about dosage. Right? So unlike games for education, where you measure people's learning and you just have a whole bunch of activities they do, and then you measure how much they learn, right? That's how education works. In medicine, when you intervene, if you're using a drug or doing an activity, they try and measure dosage, how much of the thing you do, to try and get a correlational line, right? Saying, well, if you do very little of this versus a lot of it, how much benefit do you get, right? So if you're giving people a drug, you look at the quantity of the amount per pill, right? And you'll see all the pills, of course, don't just say, oh, no, for a pain pill, they say, you know, 500 milligrams of blah, right? Because dosage is what's critical in chemistry and pharmaceutical areas. And when you apply a pharmaceutical model to games and you're talking about the dosage of the game, how much of the game did you get? What does dosage mean for gameplay? But if you're stuck on the first level and you just play the first level and keep dying and never get through the first level, have you had the same dosage to someone who plays all the way through? Do you get the same dosage if you were really heavily challenged and the game's nearly, like you are, it's optimal flow, you're really engaged, you're fighting really hard, and you're winning and losing, and it's great, versus someone who plays it very easily and just kind of skips through, no, doesn't even have to focus, and they get through and win, right? Same game, different person. Is that the same dosage of the game? Yeah, so it's... Yeah, so the challenge is yeah, you have to ask the individual whether or not, like, what they think the effect has been. And, of course, self-reporting is a terrible way of asking people anything, basically. We are really bad at self-reporting things. And you'll find a lot of papers, you have to kind of make that distinction between, like, perceived educational benefit and actual educational benefit, right? So when you ask people, do you feel you learned something, right? If they say, yes, we felt we learned a lot, you can't report that they learned a lot, right? You can report they felt like they learned things, right? Their impression was they learned something. We can't actually just use their opinion of what happened and say it is true. So last night, after I got home, the BBC was playing a Ask Doctors educational documentary thing, right? And I had to change channel because it was annoying me so much, because they're talking about calories burned, right? And they're saying, you know, you had 600 calories when you ate this full English breakfast. How many calories did you burn by the three different types of activity you did, right? And they've got one group to do fitness activities, one group to clean the house, and one group to just sit around doing nothing. And then they reported their calorie usage. And, of course, they just told them what their calorie usage was by the activities they're doing, right? Now, for me, that's... So, and how they work this out is they just say, well, what's the average calorie usage of someone who is not doing anything, and they just report that number. They didn't actually measure the individuals to work out how much that individual burnt. They just said, well, you're 90 kilograms, you spent an hour on the couch, therefore you burnt X number of calories. Right? Because to do it, you'd have to get invasive, and it can calculate the amount of carbon dioxide ratio coming out. Right? So the amount of carbon you're burning as you breathe out measures the amount of calories you are burning, right? Because you take food, you've stored it, you are then taking the carbon, mixing with oxygen to create energy, right? Because, of course, merging carbon with oxygen releases energy. So you are burning and you're turning solid fats into carbon dioxide. So there's the weight of carbon dioxide, of carbon you're emitting. And so you can actually measure that by taking breath analysis, right? So you put the big breathing thing on, you get people to breathe in and out, and you can measure how much carbon dioxide. That measures how much calories they're burning, right? Not just by saying, well, we just assume that you're an average person, right? Which makes a whole mockery of the personalized differences in metabolisms and everything that we know exists. And they're just saying, oh, no, none of that exists. We're just calling you an average person, right? You've got to measure it. You can't just say you're average, therefore it's this much. But yeah, so measuring, I think, is important. So if you look at the kind of four areas they talk about, so there's what are the app features, time saving and convenience, so there's the aesthetics and the sort of gamification aspects, right? So they go through these areas, right? So if we have a look at health heroes, it's kind of aimed at a, it's teenagerish kind of graphics, right? Maybe a bit tween, bit so relatively young. This is not aimed at, necessarily working professionals. So they give you a daily quiz, and you if you have a look at the you go online and have a look. They've got additional pictures, and you can still download it. I think I downloaded it at one point, but yeah. Looking at the behavioural model that they use, right? So they use a behavioural model. So they're providing so this is kind of a newish model. So they're talking about compatibility, opportunity, and motivation. Right? Now the FOG model of behavioural change, it talks about a motivation, ability, and trigger. Right? Now we talked a little bit about behavioural change models. See, we'd talk more about them. So the FOG model. That should be FOG, comma S, not FOGs, is so you do a behavior when you're motivated to do behavior, when you have the ability to do behavior, and then something triggers you to remember to do the behavior. Right? So, and the idea is that, and he certainly draws the, and the stream can see this, it as a graph with a curved line on it where you have ability, motivation, and trigger, and so what happens is, if you are below the line, you don't do the thing, and if you're above the line, you do it. Right? So, if you have high motivation, even if your ability to do something is relatively constrained, if you're really motivated, you still do the thing. Right? But all you have to do is decrease motivation a little bit, if you've got very low ability to do something. To then availability, ability to do it, and the same goes this way: is that if something's really really easy, you don't need a lot of motivation before you get into the doing the behavior area. Right? And you're saying there's some sort of crossover in the middle here, where right motivation and abilities, it's somewhat difficult to do, but you're somewhat motivated to do it. And the trigger, so the trigger is when it reminds you to basically check, right? So. Smoking activities, for example, the trigger is if you're a social smoker, end of a meeting, or you have a drink, or you're going out, and that's a trigger for the behavior. And so if you want to change your behavior, you change one of these three. So you change the ability to do things, you change the motivation to do things, or you change the availability of the trigger, and that's how you change behavior. Right? So that under that model. So under the COM model, you're doing... Is it compatible with your environment? So is there compatibility? Is there an opportunity to do the thing? And then what's your motivation? Right. So if we have a look So the behavioural change wheel, they're talking there about that capability, opportunity, and motivation. So within there. This model of talking about sources of behavior, intervention functions, and policy categories, right? So they say, like, in each of these areas, you can look at the level at which you're interacting, right? So if you go to, say, motivation, you can do it's enablement, training, and correction, and earlier automatic and reflective motivation. So motivation is kind of the automatic is you are instantly that like you're motivated to do it on the action, whereas reflection you think about it, you're cognitively, right? So it's a sort of the first one is an instinctual automatic motivation. The other is I'm motivated by when I think about this is the kind of person I want to be, so that motivates me. Right? So you can kind of think of those as different categories. And they put correction. So when you have intervention functions, if people are using rational processes to decide on what they're motivated to do, correction activities. So if you catch and punish criminals, if people are using a rational decision to commit a crime, the stronger the punishment, the less likely they are to do the crime. If they are using a rational evaluation to motivate them to do the crime. Right? What they found repeatedly is that most criminals aren't using a standard rational logic system to decide to commit a crime. Right? So what they found is like pet cruelty, for example. Right? If you have a $100 fine for kicking your dog, right, for pet cruelty, and you make that a $1,000 fine for kicking your dog, the number of people who kick their dogs doesn't change. Because you don't look at your dog and make a rational decision on whether or not you're going to kick that dog based on how much it's going to cost you if you get caught. Right? That just isn't what's motivating the kicking of a dog. It's not some kind of balancing off of cost, benefit, return, right? You're angry, so you kick your dog. It's an emotional response. It's an automatic response, which means legislation doesn't affect emotional automatic motivation responses, right? And so you have to do other things, right? You try other interventions. So the capability and opportunity. So fiscal measures in capability. So smoking is, a lot of people use smoking as a standard example in these kind of things. So one of the things you do in Norway is that you have like a lot of tax on alcohol and cigarettes. That is in the fiscal measures to try and remove people's capability to smoke unhealthily is just by making it so expensive they can't afford to. Right? You then have the other side where you try and give them legislation and correction. So you could make it illegal to smoke in your car or to smoke in public or to smoke around children. So you're not trying to remove they're not fiscal measures, they're legislation, right, to try and make things illegal. So this tries to kind of look at all the ways you can intervene in something and then give you a model for it, right? So, and Rune's our modeling guy. He likes building models. And it's as a way of kind of clarifying what you're thinking about. Right? The idea of building a model and saying, okay, do I understand the interactions? Are there any interactions here that are missing? Right? Because if you build a model and you get this connection that's missing, you're going, okay, how did these... So it's maybe sometimes only when you explicitly create the model of what's going on that you see some of the missing activities or that you clarify the links between things, right? And you ask, oh, okay, so is that the only connection between these things, right? Because you've now got a model that says this is the way they interrupt. So for modeling behavior change, you want to kind of have this idea of what are we influencing? There are challenges whenever you create a model or a pictorial representation or something, or you set up a diagram, you see this happen quite a bit, and we don't want you guys to do this problem, which is when I create a model, I go, okay, I'll draw a line there, and then I'll put things on the axis, right? So if I put, reflection here. So let's put reflection on that side and social on this side. And being reflective, being reversing, being social, are you internally reflecting on things or are you talking socially about it? The problem is I've now created a dichotomy between this and this, which may not exist. It may be that I can be reflective in a social environment, right? We can reflect together on something, right? But by creating this artificial dichotomy, saying, well, you're somewhere on this continuum, you're either here or you're here, implies that you're less of this one when you're more of that one. And that may be a stupid model because it makes no sense, right? I can also be not social and also not reflective, right? It's not like this is a continuum where here, by being not social, I'm also if I continue being more and more anti-social, I become more and more reflective about what I'm doing. And I say, no, you could just be an arsehole. So if you create a model and you do those kind of artificial dichotomies, you'll create impressions of how things are related that aren't necessarily true, or in fact are blatantly false, right? So false dichotomies is one of those standard logical fallacies. You also have to watch out when you're doing, say, a multi-axis plot, right? So if you put like capability, opportunity, and motivation, right? So if we did that one and say, let's make this if we have these three, and we do, let's see what they've got cap, opportunity, and might. There is an implication in drawing it like that, that something here, which is between capability and motivation, is somehow the opposite of opportunity. Right? Because it's the area furthest away from this thing. But that's only because we've flattened this three-axis thing down to a two-dimensional space. If you're actually saying these are three independent things, then, you know, as computer scientists, what do you do when you've got three independent things? Three independent dimensions make a three-dimensional object. So it's obviously a cube. And if I added a fourth dimension, I would have to draw a hypercube. Now, you guys probably aren't great at drawing hypercubes, because nobody is. But hypercubes, once you start having to think, okay, now how do I draw this in hypercubes so that each one of these has three parts? So each now has, instead of three outs, it has four, but they're all independent, right? And our brain doesn't like multiple independent axes, right? We have a struggle understanding them, and so we tend to repair them back, and then we get these false representations. Even a cube, if you're not used to working in three-dimensional space, like you guys are, if you've done game graphics, you're used to thinking of cubes, and you played in 3D games, so you're used to thinking of, you know, that I could have a cube where, you know, I could have zero of all three of them, or I could have maximum of all three of them. Right? Here, how would you place something that was good at capability, opportunity, and motivation? Do you place it in the middle? Is that the maximum of them? It's equally all of them. Basically, what you've done is by doing that, you've looked down this cube, down this axis, right? That goes from 0, 0, 0 to 1, 1, 1, and you've just kind of cut the cube in its center and then looked down that. So you have no idea whether this is zero all of them, deep into the board, or the maximum of them right up close to you. And so but the challenge of building models, and you get this in health as anywhere, is that if you build these models, you've got to be very careful as to what your implications are for the model. Right? What am I implying by saying that this is the way that people are motivated and how we interact with motivation? So they're trying to use an evidence-based approach. So mHealth apps with more evidence-based strategies are least popular among consumers. So there is a challenge. So one of the problems is that if you actually look at the theories, mHealth apps with the most evidence-based strategies are the least popular among consumers. So what it seems to be is if you build your app around a heavy evidence-based, most people don't actually like them. So, are they going to have an effect? And what? Why would you think the evidence-based approach seems not to work? Yeah, when they just... They ignore the consumer. They're not interested in the consumer. They consume. They kind of assume the consumer will just be the consumer, and they will do what we tell them to do. And we'll just collect evidence, and the evidence will be self-evident. And so, of course, with evidence, you'll play the game, and you'll do it because it's proper. But, you know, the game, in this case, is quite important. So... How do they go through identifying the problem? Well, so lots of work to define the problem. They brought lots of experts. They brought lots of stakeholders. They tried to minimize the scope so they'd focus on one thing rather than try and make a health app for everything. And trying to understand the target market. So they had meetings with experts and lots of patient meetings. So, okay, so trying to understand your target market. So they went through stages, identify the problem, identify the intervention, they did paper markups and then application development. Right, so they so here, like, presenting parts of the paper to give you a review. And so they had this model of, you know, you've got the child in the center, and then you have the parents and siblings, and then you have their greater social group, and then the overall environment around them. Right, and so they were looking at this kind of parents, that the child, that this near environment is the critical one for weight management. So identifying behavior, so target behavior. So who needs to perform the behavior? So in this case, who was needing to perform the behavior? So they're trying to get parents to change their behavior attitude. What they need to do differently to achieve the desired change? Nag the kids more? This is maybe kind of what they're trying to do. When do they need to do it? Yeah, basically they're looking at having this as a consistent intervention, so you want to constantly nag the kids. Where do they need to do it? Yep, so they're basically looking at it as a saying, every day at home, the parents need to change their behavior. How often do they need to do it? Multiple times a day. With whom do they need to do it? The parents and the children. And in what context do they need to do it? So if you look at, if you identify behaviors, these are some of the questions you can ask any time you're looking at an invention. Right? So this is a general structure for asking questions on who, what, when, where, how often, with whom, and in what context. Right? So there's a group of questions you can ask about an intervention. Okay. You can do a mapping, so automatic motivation, the physical opportunity, and social opportunity. So they mapped out kind of how they were going to intervene, right? And so look at emotion, persuasion, social support, the environmental context. So, you know, they're trying to map their intervention across the model that they had. So what were the, and so the part here on gamification, what was the gamification? Well, they use points. Yes, sort of non-specific rewards. So it was, you know, just points. They didn't actually give you anything because you earned a lot of points. They just gave you points. And treat it as feedback on behavior. Right? If you're doing well, you get points. If you're not doing well, you don't. Achievements, again, no non-specific reward. And again, use as feedback on behavior. Right, so that you have achievements, but again, they're just generally used as feedback. Progress bars, again, just as feedback that you're doing things. And they tried to use the quiz for information provision, instructions on how to perform the behavior, and information on health consequences. So, and the quiz was where they tried to do anything other than basically feedback on your how you're doing. The quiz was where they kind of, oh, we'll quiz them, and they'll learn because they'll associate, you know, the answers to those quiz questions with healthy eating. Right? So, oh, this is healthy for me. Now I know that this is healthy for me. Right? So in that sense, they're saying that it's people's knowledge that is missing. Right? So this isn't, For smoking, we know that this doesn't work, right? You can inform people, you can increase their knowledge about the consequences of smoking. It doesn't change their smoking behavior. So there is an impression in that quiz area that they think, hey, a quiz, they'll learn by, if they do well in the quiz, it's because they've learned things. And by doing the quiz, they'll learn things. Right? So kind of a self-reflecting kind of thing. Okay, so we're going to have a break for, we'll give a 10-minute break. You get up and go around. And then we'll come back and we'll talk about that. And we'll talk about time, well, we'll talk about that paper quickly. And then we'll go on to time to eat, which is the shorter one. The first one is kind of, it's an ordinary research paper. It's written with a build a model, try and do things, try and intervene. The time to eat one is a different approach. I haven't included diet bet in this, but diet bet is a crazy, crazy thing, which I don't know if you've looked at, but I think I put a link to it. Yeah, I told you about it. But you go have a 10-minute break, go walk around, and I will load up diet bet and I'll show it on the screen because it's terrifying. Yep. Okay, so the ethics around games of health, oh my, big deal. Yes, you're right. There is a significant challenge in ethics in multiple ways, right? So one is provision of information to parents, right? So so one of the biggest, like one of the most contentious areas at the moment in just health areas, health application is you're digitalizing your health records, right? So I got the letters about my children that I can apply to see their records, right? Because they're under the age of, I think, 12 is where it changes. And so I can see their medical records. But then there's an issue around parents seeing the medical records of kids who are going on to contraception. Because for family planning, if you are going onto the pill as a 14-year-old girl because you've become sexually active, but you don't want to tell your parents you've become sexually active, if they got to see your health record, they would see that you've been prescribed the pill, and that would create issues. So at what point does a child have privacy from their parents? And that issue of at what point does as a child, when does your health become something that you have the right to own versus your parents having the right to know? So in Norway, I think they picked 12 as the age at the age of 12, I think it is, I'll have to check, but they do that transition into, no, this is now the private information of you as an individual, and you have the right to say that your parents shouldn't know it. Right? And your doctor doesn't have the right to share that information with your parents. So, when do these games step on ethics? Well, in Norway, they're trying to work out how to do that right now, right? So they're fighting these, they're trying to work out the ethics of it. One thing that massively annoys me, for me, it undermines a lot of medical advice, is when people confuse opinion with evidence, right? So they're giving you advice. There's a bunch of advice which is evidence-related, right, where they've done studies to show that this is true. And then they give you a bunch of advice, which is things we feel like should be true without evidence. But they don't specify these are evidence-based and these are our opinions. They just lump them all as advice. Right? And it's impossible to know as a normal consumer which ones have a factual evidence base and which ones don't. The one that annoys me currently is the antioxidants. Right? You guys have all heard of antioxidants? Yeah. And you got lots of things talking about, you know, twice the antioxidants of oranges or something, right? And combat free radicals and things. the medical literature currently says there is no evidence to support that antioxidants are a health benefit at all. Foods that are high in antioxidants are good for you, but not because of antioxidants, right? The antioxidants are just a good measure of food that's healthy. But if you extract things out and just try and take antioxidants, no health benefits, right? So it's an indicator, but it's not the core feature. Right? So it's correlated with like whatever else is in vegetables that happen to be high in antioxidants, like vitamins and minerals and all the other things that you get in fruits and vegetables that happen to also be high in antioxidants. They happen to be good for you. But if you try and strip out just that element and give it to people, no benefit. So it's kind of one of those, yay, lots of antioxidants. No, it's not the antioxidants. No, it's not antioxidants. It's that they're good whole fruits with lots of vegetables and lots of minerals and vitamins and are good for you, right? So, yes, it's a measure, but it's like saying, you know, you should have like some, so and people say, you know, you've got to have some green things on your plate, right? And I mean green as in salad, not potatoes with green food coloring. Right? Just because it's green doesn't mean it's actually good for you. It could be moldy and green, right? Don't eat the green carrots. They've gone green from mold. The kind of default rules of how to do things are, again, really annoying. And it becomes an ethics of things, right? When ethically, when do you recommend something? Do you recommend it when you have evidence or just when you think it's true? And do you recommend people want certain things to be true? Like, so vegetarians, so we're having this debate on the bus on the way back from Trondheim. Is vegetarianism healthy? So the University of London research Marish and I were having this debate. It appears that yes, you die of different things as a vegetarian, right? So you decrease some of the risk of heart attacks, right? But you raise other mortality factors. So what they found is that if you match health conscious people, right? Because people who don't care about their health do die earlier, right? But if you are health conscious, it doesn't matter whether you eat meat or not, you're still going to die about the same time, just of different things, right? And so health and like healthy weight is a big one I sort of get upset about, because the healthy weight range is defined by the range at which you are least likely to die from health-related conditions. Your lowest morbidity, right, or mortality is in 27, is in the overweight range. So you are less likely to die from all causes if you are slightly overweight. Right? You're less likely to die from things like diabetes and from heart disease, but you're more likely to die from cancer and other things that are wasting diseases because you don't have the additional bit of resources required to compensate for suddenly losing the ability to eat and becoming nauseous and going through chemo, right? So if you want to decrease your chance of dying all causes, you need to be slightly overweight. So is slightly overweight the healthy weight range? How are we defining healthy if you're less likely to die when you're in an unhealthy... So when you define things, what you recommend to people becomes an ethic, like what evidence do you have to support your opinion? For me, ethics is a massive challenge. But you should get up and walk around, because I should stop talking to you, because it's unhealthy for you to sit for too long. I'll just take this down and go get myself a drink so I stop talking, and I'll be back in 5 minutes. So we make the well, the reason why I make the tension is because within serious games, normal game mechanics on the market are about looking at people playing the game more. Right? So why are people playing it, what the turn is, daily active users, monthly active users, they're focused on the game and how much people play it and potentially how good they play more. Once you're doing serious games, you then attach those metrics to other metrics that are outside of the game. Right? So you're interested in measuring people's health, so you're measuring their knowledge, and so you and then you're trying to tie those metrics together. Right? So and maybe it is that you use some and like so you've got no work, right? You can sometimes for games for screening, you look at the way they play in the game and take those metrics out to say something about the health. Right? Not something about the game and how they are more, but something about an outsider. Right? So you then look at a metric on someone might be a weight or their cognitive function and their performance in the game. And so you take the metrics out of the game and you correlate it to the metrics from reality. So taking game analytics and game metrics from within the game and then applying it to the outside world. And then do it the other way, where you take the outside world and say, okay, what else would we need to instrument in the game? What more data would we need out of the game? It isn't about really the game, but it's things we want to know about the player when they play the game. Okay? So reaction time might not be relevant to you as a game company trying to work out. So I've talking to Destiny about I want to know about tutorials and how people are playing their sport. So I want to know the number of the length of time between when they see a message pop up and when they respond to that and perform that action. Okay? Doesn't make the game any better for you. Like, they're not going to use that information in the game to change the game. So it'd be irrelevant if they never get a person. Okay? But if I want to know something about the cognitive processing of people, who are they reading, how much they're reading, like, and I want to know what their status is, then I might want to put other things out of the game. And so when you're talking characterization, then you can talk about what other metrics you have, how those metrics correlate with normal health metrics analysis. So yes, you do tend to do some normal game metrics analysis, but then you also try it for the outside end. And the effect you want to have, right, because if you're doing serious games, so you still want to have something, you want to be doing something other than entertainment. Goes back to the metrics. So, I think the mic went on, or the screen.
Okay, so, now I can actually see what I look like. Before we move to time to eat, let's just review some of one of the things you said is you didn't feel like they really cared about the game aspect in that first paper at all. Right? It's a challenge whenever you look at this area of games for health is when you put a bunch of experts, health experts in a room, they will make decisions from their health expertise rather than a gaming agency perspective. And that creates significant challenges, particularly if there's more of them than there are other game developers, or if they're funding it, right? So the client versus and customer are when they're different things, right? So the person who plays the game, the kids, aren't the ones paying for it, right? So when you have someone paying for a game that's different to the person using the game, if the game designers listen to the people paying, right, the customer, people paying for it, the client, then you say, well, you know, okay, well, you're paying the bills, so, eh. So you make a terrible game that nobody's going to play, but is the way that the medical professionals want it. One of the biggest challenges in medicine and in health is that doctors and medical professionals are often focused on what is best for you. Right? So they believe that they have evidence and they have information to decide what is best for you, and they say, well, this is the logical thing to do. You should do that thing. They don't give you a whole bunch of options and say, hey, you should work it out yourself, or give you agency or choice. They're telling you, no, this is what you do. For some people, that works fine. Gamers tend to want more agency, and so if I want to have some control, the standard medical advice tends to take that away. Right? This was most evidence for me in recommendations. Right? So what drugs you should take when you've got certain conditions. Right? So they look at drugs and they look at the side effects. So if you take this drug, you'll lose these abilities. If you take this drug, you'll have these side effects. Right? And what they do is they try and weigh those up and then make a recommendation of which drug someone should take. Rather than say to the people, okay, here are the three drugs you could take. Here are the side effects of those drugs. You choose which set of side effects you're most worried about. Right? Because if one of the side effects is, you get numbness in your fingers. Right? For me, fine, I'll have numbness in my fingers, whatever. Right? For a musician, that might be a massive problem. They'd rather have you have to sleep 14 hours a day, but you get perfect finger control, right, as a musician. Right, rather than, whereas me, I say, no, I'm not going to sleep 14 hours a day. I can't afford that. I'd rather have slightly numb fingers and be awake for 16 hours a day. Right? So but the medical system has to make a single recommendation for everybody, and so they don't give you choice, and so they tell you how it's supposed to be, and it's a different mindset. And I think that's a problem with games, is because they don't kind of line up with the user should have choice. Okay, so, time to eat. This was kind of a bit more fun. So what do you guys think of time to eat? Having read it. More like an actual game. So, felt more game-like. So it was focused on the children, so it felt more like a standard game that's focused on the people playing the game. Yep. What are your other thoughts? Yeah. So there are some massive challenges in how cheating works in the game, right? So, and this is one of the things that you often, again, you find with people who are designing games for health and medical games. These are usually people who care about health, and their default assumption is that everybody cares about health in the way they do, and so why would someone cheat? They can't imagine that you might cheat the game because, the game makes you healthier. Of course you want that. And it's kind of, yeah, but, if they're just after the points, they're not got the same motivation as you. And it's very hard to use empathy and put yourself in other person's motivation. So often you'll find people will design games and they won't think about how people cheat in their game that they've designed. Right? Or how people manipulate the system to avoid the benefit that they're trying to have. So if we have a look at this, we can do some analysis. Main objectives, to encourage healthy behavior. Game as a tool to change habits, right? They're trying to make this a long-term change. They wanted to understand the game mechanics as a way of you know, manipulating people's behavior. So they use mobile phones. And the manual task of this—it's a manual task for assessing food quality. This is unscalable in every possible way, as far as I can see. But and also a significant challenge on motivation when you, like this was when the iPhones were new when they did this, right? So 2010. Right? When you give someone a mobile phone. That's a new high-end piece of tech. How motivated is that person by the fact you're giving them an iPhone rather than a very new phone, rather than what your actual game is? Yeah, at that time it was, there weren't Android devices, so it was the big deal, right? So if you're giving people this, amazing, I'm the first of my friends and the first in my neighborhood to have this, right? You know, massive reward just for participating. How likely is that kid to try and tell you that what you've done is great? And how do they feel that you might take the phone away if they don't say nice things, right? So yeah, there's very much of a kind of an issue on, and it goes down financial incentives. If you pay people to participate in research, how true are the feelings you get, right? And you see, it even goes down. And this is like, you've got to understand how people are, but you've got to, when you give people money matters even. So if you're going to pay people to participate in research, if they arrive and you give them the money instantly, right, and you go, okay, well, you pay $10 to participate in this experiment, you arrive and you give them $10, their opinions are different than if you wait to the end of the experiment and then give them $10. Right? So it's not just that you paid, it's when you pay matters, right? Because if you hold off payment, they're more likely to want to agree with you until they get the money. Right? But once you give them the money first, they're kind of freed from some of the, oh, so I've already been paid, so I can say bad things because you're not going to take my money away from me now. Right? So even subtle things like that can change the way people respond to surveys and to activities. So their design was, hey, Tamagotchis are cool, we'll make a Tamagotchi for food. Right, so that's kind of as deep as analysis really went. And, you know, kids do like avatars, they do attached avatars, and so if you have a puppy avatar, and, you know, happy and sad, and relatively simple things. Again, the process, you take photograph food, that gets sent to a nutritionist. The nutritionist gives you a score for how healthy that food is, and that score comes back through in your app and makes your animals healthier. Right? So it's manually read by someone. And do they know if this is like the photo you actually took right now? Right? Because it doesn't actually, you just upload a photo. So, you know, an obvious cheat was, right, I have a healthy meal, I take a photograph, I move it over there a little bit. So I take six photographs on the one day, and then each day I just send in that photo, the next photo in the list. So that was slightly different, that's fine. Yes, we extensively tested that prototype game with the target demographic before deployment, right? So the idea here is that you show a bunch of kids the game, they tell you whether or not it's good or not, and then you go back, you change things, and you put it back in front of them, you change it, back in front of them, change it back. So they see it extensive with the target demographic. So how much, with whom, and what result. So they just say extensive testing with the target demographic. So how many tests is extensive? Is two extensive? Is 10 extensive? Yeah, so that was the number, but in their testing phase, they don't tell you how often they tested it, or with whom they tested it, or what the results of the testing were. They just say, we did extensive testing of our prototypes. Very loose. Be more specific. So, changing. So interviewer, you don't eat breakfast. Do you feel like the pet game changed the way that you eat at all? Student, a little. Interviewer, a little. Student, yeah. What kind of changes did you make? Student, for the pet, I ate breakfast. Okay, so how durable is that change likely to be? Not durable, right? And once if the only reason the kid is eating breakfast is because they saw the pet get better, if you take that away at the end of the game, are they going to continue to eat breakfast? You have no evidence that they're going to, one way or the other, right? And there's some evidence that from other studies where that when you intervene and give people a different motivation to do something, an extrinsic motivator like someone else's health or someone else's money, or giving money, that when you take away that extrinsic motivator, it decreases your intrinsic motivation. So in this case, if the kid had occasionally been eating breakfast, just because, you know, I felt like it, and then you bring in the pet, and they go, oh, okay, well, I'll eat for the pet. They then associate eating with doing it for the pet. When you take the pet away, take the phone away, go, oh, I just won't. So afterwards, they might find that they actually eat less because of this extrinsic motivator being now the reason why that kid eats breakfast. Right? And yes, I mean, this is the interview also kind of pushing quite hard to try and get, and the kid's probably working out. Like, so this for me is also a bit of a leading question. So the interview states by making a statement, you don't eat your breakfast. Do you feel like the game changed the way you eat at all? Right? So it implies that saying, well, no, would be, you'd be objecting to the interviewer, right? You'd be disagreeing with the interviewer because the interviewer had implied, like, by saying at all is kind of pleading for, a little. Because, you know, I know that the interviewer wants me to say a little in this situation, right? Just by the nature of the way the question's asked. And then the interviewer pressures on, a little? What do you mean? Oh, yeah. What kind of change? okay, I ate some. you could see a kid answering this, even if they didn't eat any breakfast, just because they know what the interviewer wants. Right? So this is a problem with interviews and with kids talking, and not just measuring whether the child actually ate breakfast more often, just asking them, did you change? Like, yeah, what do you think? So, attachment. In some cases, the student's attachment to their phone encouraged their attachment to the pet. So they liked the phone, so they thought the pet was great. Student. Interviewer. Do you feel attached to your pet? Well, attached, but attached to the iPhone. and you like the pet because of the iPhone? They go well together. That's a whole bunch of leading there, isn't it? I mean, surely this, and you like the pet because of the iPhone, they go well together, question. That's not a question. I'm telling you what to think and checking you agree with me. Right? I'm going to be sad when I have to give it back. Yes, not the pet. So I'm also not sure. Like they do, in some cases, the student's attachment to their phone encouraged their attachment to the pet. You cannot use that as evidence. The student at no stage says anything about their... They say a lot about being attached to the phone. They say nothing about being attached to the pet. This is not evidence that this top statement is true. This is evidence that students were attached to their phones. So making a research statement and then providing evidence that doesn't support your statement, not a good look, right? And leading with those questions, that's a terrible way of doing objective analysis, right? Because there is no way that second question there is not leading. And the student even pushed back and didn't agree with them. They were told, they go well together, right? And wanting the student to say, yes. But the student went, I'm going to be sad when I have to give it back. My phone. So it enabled attachment to it. But yeah, so it's a kind of casually written, and I think you've got to be really careful on some of these things, right? So any psychological kind of leading questions, you're kind of invalidating a lot of your responses. So questions. Okay, so do you think adding social features would improve time to eat? Because it wasn't really social. Your pet is doing. Yeah, so your pets are in a playground together, and so other people get to see that your pet is fat and lazy, or that your pet is really tired or something. So the significant risk, and this is why Rachel stopped using the Fitbit, is that if you set objectives and you set conditions and then you compare those and you say, right, if you don't make this mark, you've failed, a bunch of people who will feel bad because, you know, I don't want to put my pet out in public because I can see that my pet isn't doing well and I don't want to be shamed, right? Now, there are some people who respond to shame by kind of, you know, that's good, right? They use shame to their benefit and they go, I don't want to be shamed, therefore I'll work harder to avoid shame. There are other people, when you shame them, they crumble and they just stop interacting and they don't go out. And, you know, so shaming has varying effects on different people. And I think probably the people who were failing in time to eat are potentially the kinds you don't want to shame about it. Right? So, yeah. Do you think the image recognition as a way of, what do you think of image recognition as a way of detecting meals? Do you think it's going to be realistic? As a kind of, yep, and you can find some things that exist. Yep. Whole fruit, but once it's been cut up or in pieces or like piled, like knowing, so you know, if you've got a bowl of porridge and you've cut bananas on top, but all you can see is banana rounds because you've got a bunch of bananas on top of porridge, did you just eat a bowl of bananas? Yes. Yes, or do you see it and you just see ice cream and there's no banana there at all? because layers are how we don't tend to portion our food off to just like a lump there, a lump there, a lump there, a lump there, and a lump there, all independent. And I've seen the way that, like, you go to buffets and you pile your food up, right? It's kind of all overlapping, right? So yeah, it is a challenge. Do you think linking other activities to pet care is a good model? This is in general. So is the Tamagotchi model a good way, do you think? So is being good at looking after your pet then going to actually encourage you to eat and think about your eating? Or are you doing it merely as a kind of instrumental approach? You're doing it merely to achieve a result rather than it being the result itself. So yeah, by linking it too strongly to something that's an abstract thing, like looking after a pet, there is a challenge, right? And so, and this is something you need to understand when you're designing games for health, is if you add pet care as your model, what are you doing when you remove the pet? Right? Is the pet really going to live there forever? Right? I mean, surely this is not a long-term, forever kind of relationship you're forming attachments to here. And so Rachel also has the so we've had the debate, and I've seen this on TV as well, is the, I don't want you to do the dishes. I want you to want to do the dishes. Right? So for many people, there's the, that you are, you in, you want it to be tidy, right? They want you to want the house to be tidy, not just to tidy the house, right? Because they want to share the responsibility for deciding that, right? Now, if you just set up things like we talked about, the dating game where you say I love you to your girlfriend to get the points, right? She doesn't want you to say I love you. She wants you to feel that you love her. So the action, the eating healthy food, right, or the eating the breakfast, it's not that we actually just want you to eat breakfast. We want you to eat healthily. That's the intent. The action, if you're motivated by just trying to solve the pet puzzle, once that motivation goes away, you then stop. You've not changed your intrinsic motivation, your intrinsic attachment, and understanding of why you should eat food, right, in the mornings. So if we have a look online, we can also... partly why this whole area is so challenging is because it's hard to do both alignment and engagement and have a positive health effect. Right? All of those things together make this a very hard area. So it's now 11 o'clock. I don't know if there's someone else in this room shortly. Oh, where did that go? Oh, it did go there. Okay, so these are the topics people have signed up for. So Bjorn, your game technologies. Okay. And Magdalena has games for brain training. Eskil, you've gone with games turning task into game. Doing game metrics. Game metrics is interesting. So I can give you some other papers on game metrics. Yep, okay. And so we have games for scientific discovery, and games for Johnny's gone into games for rehabilitation, Alex's propaganda games, and scenarios games for politics. Though I think those three are actual remote externals. Thomas certainly is. So games for diet and weight loss. So what we want to do is work out for next week what will be presented, and get the papers for those. And how we present those in class, right? So we give out the papers basically today, and then you have a week to prepare and present. So that will be next week, not Tuesday. We'll make it for Thursday. I've made sure my Thursday is available. So we'll make it the Thursday. So we've got a week from now, and we are supposed to decide which of these pairs, so which two areas, we'll do next week. Okay. So, now, I don't know if we have anybody on the stream here. Oh. I did that whole thing, and I hadn't clicked the start broadcasting. So, they're there, but they're not there. So, but we've been streaming on here the whole time. So, so people on the YouTube channel will have to go and have a look at our previous stream. I don't know if there's anyone on here. What I'll go is, at this stage, seeing Alan. Okay, it goes to 11. Yeah. Okay. Well, I've. Okay.
mute the microphone, turn the camera off. Okay, so now I think it can hear me there, and you can see me there. Okay. I'm still trying to work out what that's doing, but it seems to be going live. So we need to work out what of these groups we do next week. What I suggest I do is I'll email out these people rather than making a decision with just the guys here. I'll email them today, right? And my default will be, because Alex and Thomas are both distant students, and I think Snorra is a distant student as well. So he can make it up occasionally, I believe. So we have Magda could also be brilliant on brain training. Let's see, behavioural change, because basically what I like to do is I like to pair two relatively similar areas or areas that are somewhat interesting, right, and put them on the same day. Yeah? And so things like usually elderly and brain training often go together, right, because one of the challenges with elderly is cognitive decline, and brain training is, again, related to that, right, so there's perfectly reason to put Aland and Magda together. Technologies and metrics are often put together, because if you're going to do game metrics, I'll give you some papers. Yep. So you're doing game metrics and you're doing technologies. They also have a similar feel of the technical aspects of making games rather than the social aspects, right? So those two usually go together. And scientific discovery and propaganda can often go together, right? Because propaganda and politics actually probably even tie together. So Snorra and Alexander probably can do each other's papers, right? And so rehabilitation and behavioural change. Behavioural change often are longer than rehabilitation. Rehabilitation is often short. If we went with behavioural change and